its power to dissipate or fall victim to our own version of ego and abuse and dislocation? Can I take up drops of ocean and fling them far and wide as a calming spray, a baptismal rain that it says, this is senseless, this is suicidal, this is absurd? Is it naive to think that a tsunami of kindness and tolerance and commonality might bathe the battle and killing fields with peace? Is it too much to expect that we can, through memory, through a wave of healing water, put an end to the worst of who we can be? Can the ocean lead us away from such darkness into redeeming light? A poem by Emily Dickinson occurs. Exultation is the going of an inland soul to sea, past the houses, past the headlands, into deep eternity. Bred as we among the mountains, can the sailor understand the divine intoxication of the first league out from land? We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is...
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wet'lala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Today's show includes information about how indigenous peoples of the Oregon coast used native plants. Traditional methods of safely cooking and processing these plants allowed tribal groups to safely handle and consume them. Without this knowledge, attempting to process and eat these plants could cause you harm. Enjoy the show, but do not attempt to replicate any of these methods or consume any plants discussed here.
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Central Oregon coast. I'm very pleased to be in the studio today with author Patty Wearat Phillips. Patty is the author of Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians, and we'll be talking about the inspiration behind her book, as well as the important cultural and historical uses of plants here along the Central Oregon coast. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I'm super excited that you're here. Before we begin, can you tell me a bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, I grew up in Coos Bay, actually on the east side of the bay, up Kentuck Slough. We lived on a hill above a swampy draw. So I spent pretty much every summer of my childhood chasing after every berry that came ripe. You know, so salmon berries were the first ones. They'd be ripe early June, you know, when school was still in session. So when I'd be walking back from the bus, you know, I could just snack on salmon berries and then thimbleberries as they came on. And as summer went on, you know, I first chased after the native blackberries because they're, at least they used to be ripe in early July, and with the climate change, everything's moving around, it's getting confusing. But that's what I used to chase after, the native blackberry. And a few weeks later, the Himalaya blackberry, I'd be picking them like crazy. We were also lucky in that we had a couple of really nice patches of red huckleberry.
Ooh.
And those take a lot of work to pick because they're so small, but they're really good. I remember one year my mom made this lovely scarlet jelly.
That sounds wonderful. You know, I love those native blackberries. They are so good. I walk all over my neighborhood. I know everywhere where there's little patches of them, and I never tell any of my friends where they are. They're hard
almost
to find.
Almost as bad as gold. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Annoying.
They are so good. Well,
Patty,
I really love your book, Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. And I'm wondering if you can tell me what inspired you to write this book.
Well, one thing as a kid, I didn't really have much of an interest in plants other than the berries I could eat. And I liked to watch all the critters that came around. We had a pretty good deer population, and they trusted us enough that they would often bring their fawns around, which was adorable. Love little spotted fawns.
Aww.
And all the birds, and my mom in particular would maintain these bird feeders, you know, with seeds, and that's the hummingbird feeders. So we had lots of animals. So I was really fascinated with the animals. And that kind of led me to then go on to Oregon State University, study biology, and I focused on animal biology. And I think I mentioned it in the book, botany was a struggle. I do remember having one botany class and trying to look at plant tissues under a microscope. And I couldn't tell one tissue from the other. I was just really exasperated. So I didn't really think about ethnobotany much till years later. I mean, the next thing I did after studying biology, I got a bachelor's in biology. I'd also had a long-standing interest in the native languages because when I was a small child growing up in the 70s, I never heard anybody using any native words. I mean, I knew, you know, there used to be another language, not English, but I never heard any words. I was kind of curious about it. In the early 80s, my dad had started acquiring a lot of sources, you know, a lot of paperwork, these ancient, you know, well, to me, ancient linguistic and anthropological paperwork, notes by linguists from the 40s and the 30s and even earlier. And of course, linguistics uses its own symbols to represent sounds in a language. So when I'm looking at these papers, a lot of the symbols were very unfamiliar, so I got very curious about them, and I finally decided if I was ever going to figure out how to say these words and what they meant, I would need to study linguistics. So I wound up starting the linguistics program at the University of Oregon in 93 and graduated in 96, and ever since then I've been working off and on over the years on our tribe's languages, which we have three of them just to make life complex. On Coos Bay, there's actually two related but distinct languages, Honus and Miluk. And then the Siuslaw and Lower Umpqua people actually spoke dialects of the same language. And Honus was the best documented, so I've worked on that the most. But here in recent years, I've been working also a lot more on Miluk and Siuslaw as well. Siuslaw is quite the delightful challenge. It has something like more than 100 suffixes, so that's a lot.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, I wound up getting interested in ethnobotany because when I was working in the cultural department for the tribe back in the late 90s, there was a University of Oregon student that wrote to the tribe asking about medicinal plants, and that was just not a subject I'd ever thought of before. So I was kind of curious, like, oh, that's an interesting question. I'm going to see what I can find out about that. And very quickly ran into this irritating wall in that I found there hadn't been much published on medicinal plants or any aspect of ethnobotany for Western Oregon tribes. I found none of the anthropologists or linguists or ethnographers who'd passed through over the 100-plus years they'd been coming around had had a particular interest in plants. Sometimes it would come up in discussions about food. One person, Melville Jacobs, did ask a lot about baskets from a weaver, luckily. But information about plants tend to be pretty scattered. And so what I did is I was putting all the information in the spreadsheet. You know, just as I'd find something, I'd grab that information and plomp it, you know, in the spreadsheet. And I talked to some of the elders, too, which is fun. You know, some cultural practices died out early on, and some persisted quite a bit. I noticed, besides, you know, berries, a lot of native teas, people had never stopped using those, and some of the native greens, you know, people would collect those. And then I did learn from my older cousins, I always thought this was so funny, that the ancestor, who was pretty much universally known as Grandma Mom, her name was Frances Talbot Elliott, she lived well into her 90s, so, you know, she was well known to a lot of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and she would make a cold medicine by taking a little bit of the root of skunk cabbage and grinding it up and mixing it with some honey to make it more palatable and give it to kids as a cold medicine.
Wow.
And and apparently that was kind of peppery. I'm like, oh my, I'll bet it was. Because normally how you use skunk cabbages, you have to cook it. I mean, this was something I thought was interesting as I did my research. Skunk cabbage is a member of the arum family. It's actually a distant cousin to taro, which is a widely grown root vegetable throughout the South Pacific and parts of mainland Asia. And both taro and skunk cabbage have these calcium oxalate crystals in them. So it's actually very dangerous to bite into like a skunk cabbage leaf or the skunk cabbage root or a taro root unless it's been cooked, because you have to break down those crystals. So they'll cause the mucous membranes of the mouth and throat to swell up. But there is something about skunk cabbage. I did look it up in an herbalist book. It is supposed to help with chest colds. But yeah, it's like, cook it first.
Yeah,
it's gonna break down those crystals. But yeah, Grandma Mom had this kind of scary medicine that the kids did not like. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, I can tell you, after smelling skunk cabbage, I would be probably terrified as well. But very interesting. Well, Patty, I'm wondering, we've been talking a little bit about some of the uses of these plants. Can you just provide a quick definition of the term ethnobotany to make sure everybody listening understands?
Yeah, basically, it's where the study of human cultures, so anthropology meets botany. So it's, how does a particular culture interact or use plants? So you can see that's pretty broad, because, you know, growing wine grapes, the different wines, you know, that people have made for thousands of years, that falls under the umbrella of ethnobotany. Breeding different varieties of wheat and making bread, that's ethnobotany. Then for the Pacific Northwest, you know, a lot of folks don't usually put a lot of thought into how indigenous cultures used plants, maybe beyond, you know, cedar canoes and cedar plank houses, because the view is, you know, it's a fishing culture, which isn't totally inaccurate. You know, I mean, salmon,
right,
and also lamprey, and then on the coast, a lot of other fishes are very, very important, you know, historically and today, but it's not the whole picture. The green world, the plant world, was really important also, and so it's just kind of fun to try and bring out some of that information that a lot of people just weren't very aware of.
Yeah, you know, your book really does a great job of that. Can you expand a bit on how the languages and people are related?
Well, culturally, the people are very related. It's the language and culture situation of Western Oregon is pretty complex. And the Kuspe, Lower Umpqua, Sayuswa, Alsi, and Yaquena people are all kind of sandwiched in the middle between two different very language groups and cultures. So to the north are the Tillamook people. They are usually identified as the southernmost of the Salish language speakers. So the Salish language family is a large language family concentrated mostly in Washington and British Columbia. There are some interior Salish languages in eastern Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And then to the south of us, so beginning, like say, in the upper Coquille watershed and all the way down through Curry County into Northern California and Smith River, as well as some interior folks like the upper Umpqua of Roseburg vicinity, spoke Athabascan. which is yet another completely different unrelated language family. Most of the Athabascan languages are actually concentrated in Alaska and the adjacent bit of northwestern Canada. There's another branch of Athabascan folks, well, in California, like the Hoopa and Sinkyon and Matole, and then out in the desert southwest, the Navajo and Apache peoples are also Athabascan. So it's a pretty large language family. And then smushed in the middle is us, and nobody knows quite what to do with our languages. They're a bit odd.
Interesting.
Yeah, right now we're in a bit of a junk pile category, I call it. Mostly we're labeled right now the Coastal Oregon Penutian. There is a language family called Penutian that is mostly concentrated in Oregon and California, and then kind of an interior Oregon, Klamath Modoc, Takalma, Kalapuya, Tahapton, you know, along the Columbia River, I think Nez Perce. And then there's us on the coast. It's like, well, maybe you guys are Penutian, but possibly not.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Our languages apparently do have a fairly heavy Salish influence on them, but aren't at their core Salish. And that's just probably from centuries of sustained contact with the Tillamook, because there was a lot of trade there, also sometimes warfare. The Tillamooks did have a rather naughty habit of trying to come down and kidnap people and then sell them into slavery on the Columbia River. So
that's not good.
No, not great. Yeah, so the Siuslaw-Umpqua language, as best I can tell, is not super closely related to anything else. It's a bit closer to Alsi-Iquina than it is to the two Coos Bay languages. But I think at their core, they are distantly related, you know, going back a few thousand years. And then, of course, it gets complicated because these language communities were in constant contact. You know, they travel back and forth all the time to trade, to intermarry. One huge gathering spot, particularly between the Hana-speaking communities of Coos Bay and the Huich, the Lurumpa people, was around the Ten Mile Lake. It used to be there was a lot of wapato that grew there. That's a food plant. So there'd be big gatherings there, as well as used to be a really good salmon and lamprey fishing place. And so there was a lot of language that went back and forth, because I'll find words, especially in the Kuich dialect as opposed to the Siuslaw dialect, that appear to come out of Honus, but then there's some influence coming back the other way from Umpqua Siuslaw into the Coos languages. So it's just really interesting to kind of see these influences, you know, in terms of like language and plant use, because of course a lot of the uses of the plants were very similar between these cultures.
That's fascinating. And you know, Patty, the next question I have for you was to ask you about some of the key historical or cultural pieces of information that you would like to share from your book, because I'll tell you, the first 25 pages of your book it's pretty amazing. Everybody should read that information. And I really just learned so much about the important history of Indigenous peoples here on the Central Coast from your book. And I'm wondering, is there some key information that you'd like to share, or are we saving that for another show?
It would probably be a whole show in itself.
That's what I'm thinking. So what I'm wondering is, would you be interested in coming back on the show?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, great. It sounds like, from what you just said, the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw peoples used plants in a similar way. Is that true?
Locally here among these tribes, it was more similar than not. There are subtle differences as you go over a certain distance. Like, I know in Northern California, they will use willow sticks a lot in stick baskets. But as you move north, I'm not sure exactly where the switch happens, but somewhere in Curry County, and then certainly from Coos Bay to Siuslaw, they tended to prefer hazel sticks over willow sticks for stick basketry. So it is kind of like these subtle shifts of cultural preference. And another one that also goes back to basketry is, if you look at baskets with design, it's pretty common to see, you know, white and black overlays. The white is pretty much always bear grass. But the black overlay can be many different things. And again, if you go into Northern California and then the Athabascan-speaking peoples of southwestern Oregon, they tend to use maidenhair fern for the black overlay. At Coos Bay, it switches where using eelgrass is dominant for the black overlay in baskets. Then with bark skirts, from Northern California up to Coos Bay, Lower Umpqua region, women tended to make their nice skirts from the inner bark of the big leaf maple. You can go further north, so by the time you get to the Dallas Bee people, it's mostly the inner bark of red cedar. So Eastlaw is kind of in an interesting transitional zone. You have a lot of maples there in the Eastlaw country, and of course a lot of red cedars too, so you would probably find a mix of skirt type. And of course there was a fair bit of intermarriage, you know, not only with the Little Umpqua people to the south, but also with the Alsea people to the north, even though some cultural things didn't make the jump very often between Eastlaw and Alsea, because the Alseas are the southernmost people to regularly practice head flattening, and the Eastlaw people didn't do that. There's only a handful of Eastlaw people in the old days that had flattened heads, and usually that was because they had an Alsea mother.
Interesting.
Who really wanted to make sure their kid had the fancy sloped forehead. So there was a bit of teasing back and forth. You know, they'd call us the seal heads, which I'm fine with. I think seals are cute.
Yeah,
we'd
they
call
are
them
adorable.
The bread heads after, like, flat bread. So it's kind of funny.
Well, one of the things that was super interesting to me was to learn how indigenous peoples actually cultivated introduced crops. For example, potatoes. Of both introduced crops and native plants, which plants were most widely cultivated and how they practiced land management techniques to encourage the growth of desired plants?
You know, we kind of have to speculate a bit on some of it because there has been some really good research that was done on this in British Columbia, Western Washington, and also California. With Western Oregon, you know, so early on, people got decimated by the epidemics, and then so many of the Western Oregon tribes were forcibly removed from their homeland. So a
right.
lot of knowledge about these traditional practices didn't get passed on, at least not as much as in neighboring areas. Yeah, what we do know is tobacco was widely cultivated throughout the region. In fact, it seemed to be the most babied of the plants, like it needed the most help. And they would put the most effort into growing it.
Interesting.
And locally, they would burn a patch, scatter the tobacco seeds in there, and then surround the patch with, like, brush fences to keep the wind off of it so that the tobacco could grow nicely. You know, the practices were fairly similar, apparently, throughout the Northwest. And I did read one anthropologist's paper. She was talking about early adoption of growing potatoes among the Haida and the Tlingit, you know, from British Columbia and coastal Alaska. And she thought that because these people had already had a long-standing tradition of growing tobacco, it was very easy to just kind of take that knowledge and apply it to potatoes. And potatoes was also one of the early crops introduced. Here, there is a note from an Indian agent in the 1850s that the Little Umpqua people were already growing them along the Smith River. Now, I have read in some places there's also heavy cultivation of springbank clover, and that could have been true in our area also. Camas also seemed to have some horticultural techniques added to it, and it must have worked well because another paper I was reading was talking about a study of camas ovens near Salem that were about 10,000 years old.
Wow.
You know, you go in the Willamette Valley, and of course a lot of other valleys, Umpqua Valley, Camas Valley. Camas still grows pretty thick in places to this day, so then it makes you really stop and think, like, wow, you know, cultivating camas was so successful that it was an ongoing thing for at least 10 millennia, and probably older than that, you know, because that just happened to be some of the older ovens that had been found and had gotten some burnt bulbs out of it to do, you know, some
wow.
carbon dating, carbon 14 dating.
So interesting. You know, do you feel that some of the practices might have altered some of the landscape here on the coast?
That's what most of the anthropologists think, because, you know, people were living here for thousands of years, and one of the common land management techniques throughout the whole West, actually, and East, too, is burning. So
right.
what they would do is every fall, typically after the first rain, they'd do these burns, and normally they'd be low-temperature burns. It would burn down that year's annual plant growth. And the hope was, of course, to encourage new growth come the spring. It would also tend to have the effect of kind of discouraging the spread of Douglas firs and other conifers into meadows.
Right.
You know, so it would keep these open meadows century after century. And then again, with these fires typically being low temperature, the mature trees would be safe because they can shrug right. off low temperature fires. So you'd have this interesting ecological mix, you know, of some old growth forests and then all these meadows. I mean, they do talk about going hunting and having miles of open country where it's easier to see deer. Sometimes it's reflected in the place name, like just north of Florence, there's a place called Clover Ridge, and its Sayusla name is Sahautita, and it comes from the Sayusla word Sahauya, meaning grass or brush, and it is in an area that was like part of a traditional round of deer hunting. So probably, you know, based on the name, you just kind of figure, yeah, that place was probably burned regularly, was very open, and then it kind of lives on in English with the Clover Ridge. There's probably a lot of grasses and clover that was good deer and elk browse, and then later good horse browse. Well, you look at pictures of that place today, and it's conifer forest. Oh. With a few roads punched through it,
right.
You know, because the fires have been suppressed now since the 19th century. So it's a major ecological shift.
Yeah, so interesting. Patty, one of my favorite parts of the show is asking people to share a favorite memory or story. And I'm wondering, do you have a favorite memory or story that you can share about writing or researching your book?
It has been fun over the years to be able to talk to elders, you know, about going out and gathering teas, just kind of their experiences. But maybe one of my favorite plants
yeah.
is skunk cabbage because it's just so weird. I grew up above a swampy draw. I was on a hill. Down below us, there's two streams that came down these narrow draws and joined up. So it was very swampy down there. Every spring, these vivid yellow, weirdly shaped plants would pop up out of the mud. And their smell never bothered me because I grew up with it. You know, I know some people find it too strange or kind of unpleasant. I never found it unpleasant. Weird, yes, but not unpleasant.
Yeah, I think weird is probably correct, especially
yeah.
because
there's
they're
nothing
so
quite like it.
They're just so beautiful. Like the first time I saw yeah. a skunk cabbage, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the most beautiful flower. I take photos of them all the time. And I went to smell it, of course, you know, the very first time. And I was just surprised, right? Like you would not expect that.
Yeah, and it's just a bizarre plant. And there's nothing else that looks quite like it. And then partly that's because there aren't many of its plant family, the arums, in our area. It's mostly, from what I found, a tropical and subtropical
oh,
family.
That's why. That makes sense.
But yeah, they're so wonderfully odd. And then kind of discovering that they can be eaten, but they have to be processed correctly. Because like a lot of foods, if you don't process it correctly, it's not safe to eat. At some point long ago, people figured out how to cook it properly. And I love how it appears in stories. It was important enough that it actually does appear in some stories throughout the Northwest. At Coos Bay, it appears in the trickster epic where the first of the tricksters, he offended the salmon, and so he had no salmon to eat. And he's like, oh boy, what am I going to do now for food? So he grabs a skunk cabbage root, and he tries to eat it, and he's like, bleh! So then, in a fit of pique, he just shoves it in the hot ashes of a fire and then takes a little nap. And then when he wakes up, he's like, oh, something smells nice.
Oh.
And he takes out the skunk cabbage from the ashes and it's all cooked. And now he starts taking it apart. And then with each piece he sets out, he names a different kin. Like, oh, give this to your mother, give this to your father, give this to your paternal uncle, give this to your paternal aunt, and so on and so forth, basically kind of creating... when human beings come in the world, you know, this is how their families are going to be. You know, they're going to have moms, they're going to have dads, and they're going to have aunties and uncles and so on and so forth. And so it's just kind of an interesting thing that, you know, skunk cabbage was like, one of the first foods. And he's like, okay, this is when human beings come, this is what they will do.
Wow.
They will put skunk cabbage in hot ashes. And human beings will have kinship. And this is going to be their name. And then I also love it in that it appears in a story about the little people, because the little people use the leaves as tents.
Oh.
And so kids always enjoy those stories when you tell them, okay, you know, if you happen to see a skunk cabbage leaf stuck on a stick, that's a little person's tent, and you know they've been around there.
I love that. That's great. Those are fabulous stories. I can see why that would be your favorite plant, for sure, or at least one of them.
Yeah, because it's got stories and it's just plain weird. And I love weird plants.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a good time for people who maybe tuned in late and are hearing these fabulous stories. I just want to let people know that you've been listening to Beyond Your Front Door. We've been coming to you from beautiful downtown Florence, Oregon, and I've been having a lot of fun speaking with Patty Wearett Phillips. She is the author of Ethnobotany of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. We've been talking about the historical and cultural uses of plants among indigenous peoples of the Oregon coast. We've also been talking about the different languages, farming practices, and cultural traditions related to early life on the coast. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on my playlist at soundcloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door, Oregon, and look for the Crashing Wave. Patty, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
It's been great to see kind of a renaissance in the tribes with some aspects of culture, because like I mentioned, we never quit going out and collecting wild teas and berries, but basketry, you know, people had for a period kind of stopped weaving. And certainly when I was young in the 70s and 80s, I don't remember seeing traditional weavers, but now there's been quite a renaissance and there are so many young people now taking up weaving, and it's been wonderful to see, you know, wonderful to see what they create, you know, because each basket is individual and unique and very beautiful.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Patty, thank you so much for taking time to be here today. Again, I love your book and I'm so excited to have you on the show. And I look forward to having you come back to talk about some of the history of the indigenous peoples that lived here on the Central Coast. I think that will also be a great show. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Listeners who use information from this program to venture outdoors do so at their own risk. Outdoor activities may be hazardous and must be carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program, Pacifica Radio, or any station airing this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold Pacifica Radio, KXCR, its affiliates, any station airing this program, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door, including Pacific Northwest Radio, KXCR, KBOO, KXCJ, and KCEI. And thanks to local band Jumpin' the Rails for their rendition of Smith Chapel, the theme song used on this show. And last but never least, thanks to each of you for joining me this week on another coastal adventure. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Oregon coast. I'm your host, Dina Pavlis. I'm pleased to be in the studio today with Patty Godwin, Jennifer Yoakum, and Kim Miller. All three are local kayakers who recently completed the 10 Waters, 10 Days event here in Florence. We'll be talking about the inspiration behind the event, the biggest challenges they encountered, as well as the most important takeaways for each of them. Patty, Kim, Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
I'm really excited to have you here today. Before we jump in, can you each briefly share your background related to kayaking?
This is Jennifer, and I started when I was 12 years old, and my first opportunity to paddle a red plastic kayak at some summer camp lake, and I was thrilled to be able to go where I wanted, how I wanted, at whatever speed I wanted. It was so exciting.
That's fantastic. Kim, how about you?
You know, I originally knew about kayaking as whitewater kayaking because my late husband was a whitewater kayaker. And then recently, actually only about 2 months ago, I was working with Patty on a garden tour project, and she mentioned kayaking and that she had a spare kayak. And I said, would you mind if I just tried it? And she took me out on the lake, and I fell in love with flat water kayaking and found it just to be the most peaceful, most connected place I can be.
That's awesome. You know, that's what I love about kayaking is just getting out there and when you're just gliding and it's that silent kind of quiet peace. I don't know how else. I feel like I get younger. I feel like time moves backwards. Patty, what about you?
I've been kayaking for about 20 years. I started out in Spokane, and every summer it was a day or two a summer. Then the next summer it was 10 days. And then by the time I realized it, I was kayaking every Saturday from July 1st to November 6th.
Wow.
And I loved finally having my own sport.
That's great. And Patty, you kind of were the instigator behind the 10 Waters 10 Days. So can you share a little bit about what 10 Waters 10 Days was and your inspiration behind it?
Well, for years, I have said that Florence is surrounded by these gorgeous, pristine lakes. And we have so many that one could kayak one every day and have a different experience every day. And then I just turned to the Facebook group, Florence, Oregon Area Kayakers, and offered them the challenge. And it went from there.
Yeah, it really did grow and become popular. And I'm curious, which 10 waters did you guys paddle?
We started at Sutton, and we hit every single lake all the way down to Tokenitch. And that's 8. And then I had to come up with 2 more. So we concentrated on our river, Siuslaw River, and the 9th day was Bender Landing, and the last day was out of the port towards the Coast Guard station.
And you mentioned the Florence Kayaking Group. Can you elaborate on that group, like where it is or how people can find that?
It's a Facebook group, and it's Florence, Oregon Area Kayakers. During the summer, I got a lot of people asking, can we kayak with you? I don't know where to go. I don't know. This is my first kayak. So in June, July, and August, we did a raft up, and it was a public invitation, and we were at 3 different lakes, and everyone was invited to come. The smallest group was 7 paddlers. The largest group was 18. And the fee to participate was to bring cans for food share. And it was a great way to support the community. And my goal was for people to get together having similar interests and start their own group. And that, in fact, did happen.
That's great. This next question is going to be for each of you, so I think I might go to Kim first. What did you notice about these lakes and waters that you maybe didn't notice before because you paddled them back to back?
I'll answer kind of in 2 phases. One is I used to powerboat. I had a pontoon boat and fished a lot of these lakes, thought I knew them. And when I got in my kayak, it was like a whole different viewpoint that I had. I was much more close to the water. I could see wildlife that my powerboat would have scared away. I could hear the peace that my powerboat didn't have unless I used my electric trolling motor. And I think then the 10-10, it was much more about what I learned about myself and my ability to be able to kind of rise to the challenge, especially since I was a newer kayaker. The question was, could I even paddle back to back? And to prove to myself that I could was wonderful.
That's great. Jennifer, how about you?
I grew up in Eugene and would come out to Honeyman State Park to go camping with my family all the time. And so I knew kliwaks, but only from the shore. And as much as time as I've spent in Oregon and Southwest Washington, that sort of thing, I had never actually paddled these lakes. So every lake was a new experience for me. And I was thrilled to see the similarities and the differences. And every lake has its own character and its own sights, of course, but also its own smell and its own kind of feel.
That's really true. Patty, how about you?
I love them all. To go from one pristine water to another pristine water, it's a real privilege to do that. I've been able to paddle different places in different parts of the country, and I am in awe how clean ours are and how well taken care of they are. And I want to maintain that. So then to share it with people who were experienced kayakers and were new kayakers, and to see that excitement and that dedicated enthusiasm, that was my payback.
Fantastic. Well, I'm curious, there must have been some challenges when you're trying to organize something like this, especially being the first time. I'm curious, what were the biggest challenges for each of you? And Jennifer, let's start with you.
The challenges for me was that I had just arrived in Florence. I've lived here like less than 2 months.
Wow.
And so to come in and meet this group and get so excited to meet other kayaking addicts, because we aren't just casual kayakers. This is like our thing, right? And realize I needed to take 10 days out of trying to get settled into a new house, new community in order to get paddling. Didn't quite work out for me. I only made 6 out of the 10 paddles. But oh my gosh, the whole kind of mind manipulation you go through is like, do I have time to set up the boat and clean up my gear? It's like, yes, of course I do. This is the best thing ever.
That's great. Well, welcome to Florence, too, by the way. And Kim, how about you?
You know, I think my biggest challenge was being new to kayaking. The first couple of days, I actually had a little bit of sore shoulder going on, and it was so helpful to have other experienced kayakers start to work with me about how to use my core and how to not fatigue my shoulders and be able to take care of myself so that I could paddle the long haul.
Yeah, and you know, that's really the great benefit of paddling with a group, especially when you have experienced people. I know the first time I got in a kayak, my husband and I pushed off and instantly crashed into each other. And the person who was with us, who was experienced, said, I think it's time for a paddling lesson. So it was great because she taught me how, she was a whitewater kayaker originally, mm-hmm. and now kayaks the lakes here. And so she really taught me how to use my core, and man, it made a big difference. Patty, how about you?
Well, this gang was so cooperative. We would all show up, and you knew you were going to get help getting your boat off and taken to the water. So that got to be real easy. We know how to load each other's boats now. We know who wants help getting in the water. And that also, for a new kayaker, that's always a thing. How do I get in? And then after they've done it a few times, then they don't need the help, want the help, and off they go. And so you have to gauge, do I help or do I not help?
So I'm curious, we talked about your biggest challenges. Mm-hmm. What were some of your most important takeaways from this experience? And I know we've already shared some takeaways, so if you have anything else to add. And Patty, I'm just going to come right back to you.
Well, one of the things that I found fascinating pulling a group together and getting to know these folks, because some of them I didn't know. But it didn't take long to realize that different people had different strengths and interests. So Jennifer became our safety coach. And when we would circle up and we would make sure people knew their names, and she would also give us a little tidbit to work on during that paddle. Even when we were just talking about creating this, someone said, well, we have to have a t-shirt. I think it was you also.
Yeah.
And so we found a t-shirt on Amazon, and everybody ordered their own. And that was great because it was the right size and it was the right everything. And then we've written on the t-shirts the lake that we've been on. And somebody else said, well, let's camp overnight. So Linda was in charge of that, and we camped at Takanich Landing, and then we had a small group that camped overnight, but then we invited everybody who wanted to come and their spouses for dinner. And so things like that would happen. Mary Nolte is our historian. I used some of her research for some of the stories that I would tell about each lake. And then she handled our visit to Takanich on our one and only rain day.
We really had extraordinary weather for this entire event. But I think the thing that is my takeaway is there was such extraordinary kindness and generosity and lightness of spirit around each of the paddles that we were able to participate in, and just kind of coming back into that blessing every day that we got to paddle together was really extraordinary.
That's great. And Kim, what about you?
You know, I think for me, I just got to connect to a whole new group of friends. I had a really solid friend circle that have supported me ever since I moved here. And now I have this other friend circle that is has different interests and excitement. But equally important to me. And so I think my connection to community has really increased because of it.
That's great. So one of the questions I have is, if someone wanted to paddle a number of lakes or waters back to back like you did, what advice would you give them?
My advice is make sure that you've got proper safety equipment and training to be able to manage changing conditions. So if you are going to be out in this area, to know that by 12:30, 1 o'clock, you really need to be off the water unless you've got really strong skills to keep yourself upright. I think it's great to paddle with a group whenever you can find a group and just put it out there that you're going to be at X location at X day for anybody who wants to join you. That's a great way to start. And then the other thing is just to be really clear about taking a look back. Once you've launched from a place, it's a new place, take a look back so you know what it looks like on your return, because it's really easy not to do that. And so just keeping that safety awareness around you is key for me.
Yeah, that's really great advice. And for listeners who might not be from our area, mm-hmm. can you elaborate a little bit about why we would want to be off the water on most days by noon?
That's when the wind is going to pick up. You have kind of calmer waters, calmer winds in the morning, and then the afternoon, things start to get very exciting. And if you've got the skills or the willingness to be able to do that and get out there when the winds are and the waves are choppier, go for it. But if you're a newer paddler and you have any concerns about that, yeah, go ahead and get off the water.
Yeah, and just to let people know that you can kind of anticipate more wind if it's hotter inland. And the wind can even start earlier.
It can.
I definitely remember a paddle on Tackenich with my husband where we had gone way to the very south end, and on our way back, the wind picked up. And we didn't notice the wind because we were, you know, kind of in a little cove down there. And all of a sudden, man, it was a paddle back. And it was probably the hardest paddle I ever did, literally whitewater coming up over the kayak. We tried to hug the shoreline, which I don't know if that was better or worse, but we were not the only ones out there. It was a large group paddling from, I think it was Eugene that had come out, and we got back before them, and we were resting and eating lunch in our car and watched them paddle back with the same difficulty. So that's really great advice and something for people to be aware of. And Kim, what about you? Do you have any advice that you are your newer paddler, so do you have any advice you'd give a newer paddler?
Be open to learning. There is just so much information that you can absorb and pick up as you're kind of exploring the new sport. But you've got to be willing to take in the information and maybe do a little of your own research too. I think kayaking is one of the most approachable sports I've ever done. It's easy to get into. It's relatively easy to understand and to do. But there is some information that makes it much more enjoyable.
That's true. And just like you said in the beginning, that information of learning how to paddle correctly can just make it so much more enjoyable.
The other thing that I think is important is I live on a lake and I will go out kayaking by myself. But that, you know, has a little bit of risk associated with it. So I've gotten a lot better about telling somebody that I'm going out. And I tend to stay in areas that I know if trouble happened that I'd be able to get close to shore and be able to deal with. But if I was going on a bigger lake, the buddy system works.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are lucky that there are some of the lakes here have a lot of shallow areas because they're dunal lakes. Like Kleewox is another good example in the main part of the lake, not up the arm. But if you stay in the main part of the lake, if you were to tip over, you could literally stand up in a lot of the areas there. Patty, how about you?
I agree about letting somebody know. I've done that for years. And then I also let my husband know that I'm out. So he always says, "Are you out?" That's how he answers the phone call. And we have traveled on the lakes before. I'm always amazed how you see something new each time. With a group, we always would assign a leader, and we tended to just hug the shore. And we also had a sweep, like we do in hiking.
Can you just elaborate on the term sweep for anybody who might not know what that means?
It's the person at the back and is just making sure that anybody who's lingering behind has a chance to paddle with somebody and just help them move along.
Great. And Jennifer, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, just in terms of organizing a group is going out, You have a person who's designated as your leader, who usually has a sense of where you're going, has the navigational points in mind, and then you put your slowest paddler up with that leader. And that means that your group will stay together, more of a clump, and not get stretched out so far.
Well, that's really good advice. Patty, I'm curious, are there any possible future paddling challenges swirling around your brain right now?
Well, this is off the record.
Okay. Off the record, everybody.
I'm going to talk to you about creating a quest.
I think that would be great. Let's talk about
off
that.
Off the record.
Off the record.
And I'm not really sure what that looks like.
Okay.
Because they don't even know what you do with your quests.
Okay, so we'll talk about that. There was a show for listeners who might not know what Oregon Coast quests are. There was a show about Oregon Coast questing, and you can find that show on my SoundCloud playlist at soundcloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door and look for The Crashing Wave. One of my favorite parts of this show is asking people to share a favorite memory or experience. And let's start with Kim.
I guess my favorite memory of the 1010 was paddling Munsell Lake. And Munsell, for those of you who know, is one of our smaller lakes. And some paddlers might not think of it as challenging. I always appreciate Munsell because there is so many different coves and that you can explore, and what we call nursery logs, which are basically logs that there's kind of a little plant nursery that has formed on that log out in the middle of the water. But when we paddled Munsell, we decided to do that one in quiet and peace. And what I find sometimes when you paddle with a group is everybody's talking, and sometimes the wildlife kind of disappears because they hear us coming. And to be able to just be silent and to hear your paddle dipping in the water and feel it, you know, and hear it against the bow of your boat, and be able to, you know, appreciate just the quiet stillness, but also the noises that show up on the lake if you're quiet about your paddling. It was a remarkable experience, and I will say also a challenge because I tend to be a talker sometimes.
Yeah, me too. And I saw that on that day that you went out, that the first X amount of time was going to be silent. And I thought, what a great idea, because I think there's a different dynamic to paddling by yourself silently to paddling in a group silently. And I don't know how to explain what it is. It's just something that you feel. And I love that lake, by the way. It's one of my favorite paddles, also because those coves, in some of them, there are these giant old growth trees that are underneath the water. And when that water is clear, you can just see, you paddle right over them. It's just amazing. Jennifer, how about you?
One of the things that I just enjoy so much about paddling quietly, but also paddling with some intention, maybe some speed, is the whole feeling of the dance of paddling. And being in the boat, you've got your feet working against the pedals, rotating your hips, rotating your core to get that, and that whole body engagement in paddling just feels like a dance or like music. So those moments when we had that opportunity were really special to me.
That's great. Patty, what about you?
Well, when I was thinking about an answer for this question, I thought of a certain paddle that some of us did one morning from Tiernan Landing towards Sweet Creek on the Siuslaw River. And it was a cold morning, and there was fog on the water along the shore, and we were all about as quiet as we've ever been from the launch. And we went upriver, and I have never seen so many different variations of steel blue and gray and silver looking up ahead of us. At times it felt like we were in the Swiss Alps heading towards Sweet Creek, and we were all so quiet because we could tell this was a majestic cathedral that we were paddling into. That was probably my experience from this summer that I will take with me. And all our pictures reflect that too, by the way.
Wow. All of you, what great memories and experience that you had doing this. I'm just going to take a moment to let listeners know, if you tuned in late, you've been listening to Beyond Your Front Door, produced for the Pacifica Radio Network in the studios of KXCR. We're coming to you today from beautiful downtown Florence, Oregon. I've been speaking with Patty Godwin, Kim Miller, and Jennifer Yoakum. All three are local kayakers who just completed the 10 Waters 10 Days Paddling Challenge here in the Florence area. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on SoundCloud.com. Just search SoundCloud for Beyond Your Front Door and look for The Wave. Ladies, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that anyone would like to share before we wrap up?
There are two people that I want to thank, Lonnie and Kamala. They were our mischief makers. On each of the paddles, they would creatively surprise us. We had ukulele music up on Bender's Landing. We had cookies out at the end of Kleewaks. They were precious in that way. Plus, Dale Hawning provided us with an experience of a video that featured each and every one of the lakes. And towards the end, we are on the Siuslaw River. We're heading towards the Coast Guard station, and he has some stills of us because he wasn't on the water with us. He was on the shore. And these stills show this flotilla coming and going to the Coast Guard station. And it was just a beautiful sight. It was really a parade.
Yeah, I saw that video, and people can check that out on the Florence, Oregon Area Kayakers Group on Facebook. And I saw it there, and it's really quite beautiful. Very well done. Kim, how about you? Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I guess I not so much share as encourage. I just want to encourage people who are curious to reach out, give it a try. The sport, regardless of your age, you can do it. There are put-ins where there are accessibility ramps so that it's easier to get in and out of your boat. There are places you can rent boats to at least give it a shot and see what you think. But until you've seen the glory of this area from the deck of your kayak, you just don't know how blessed we are.
Yeah, that's really true. Jennifer, how about you?
I so love kayaking, and I love introducing new kayakers to the sport, and I always encourage people to take appropriate safety precautions, particularly as we're heading into weather that starts out cool and then warms up later, to always please wear your PFD, to always please have your whistle, and now it's required to carry a flashlight with you as well, to get some basic skills training, whether it's around basic kayaking techniques or safety rescue kind of pieces. Do that. That will encourage your enjoyment and help others enjoy the sport.
Yeah, I really agree. All really great information. Well, Patty, Jennifer, Kim, thanks so much for taking time to be here today. What a great show. I thought this was really fascinating. And congratulations again on your accomplishment of 10 Waters in 10 Days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. I'll be back in 35 seconds with a special nature moment. Listeners who use information from this program to venture outdoors do so at their own risk. Outdoor activities may be hazardous and must be carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program, Pacifica Radio, or any station airing this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold Pacifica Radio, KXCR, its affiliates, any station airing this program, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability. I want to share something about water today in honor of the 10 Days, 10 Waters participants. Here's a piece from my show with Chandra Legui, author of Oregon's Ancient Forests, a hiking guide.
Streams are much more than water and far from a passive element of an ancient forest. Where a stream flows can determine where different trees, shrubs, and wildflowers grow. Likewise, the trees of a forest actively shape its streams, capturing and releasing the water that flows within winding banks, but also adding the physical structure that form pools, riffles, and lazy bends. Trees that fall into and across streams help to stabilize the stream bank in swift currents, redirecting energy and redistributing rocks and other logs. Fallen trees, sometimes piling up into huge log jams, help shade and cool the water and offer shelter to young fish. They slow water to form pools that capture gravels where trout and salmon can spawn. As they decompose, they add nutrients to the water. The pools formed by fallen trees also capture smaller forest litter, the needles, leaves, lichen, and seeds that fall from the canopy or roll down forest slopes. In a more subtle but just as important way, this smaller forest litter also shapes a stream's ecosystem. Trapped in slow-moving pools or shallow areas formed by trees, this organic material forms the basis of the stream food chain as it is shredded and eaten by tiny aquatic organisms, then insects, and fish as you move up the food chain. The diverse habitat and high water quality in ancient forest streams are also essential for amphibians like the tailed frog and the Pacific giant salamander, and birds like the American dipper, which gleans insects in fast-flowing forest streams.
If you enjoyed that piece with Chandra, check out the entire interview on my Beyond Your Front Door Oregon playlist on SoundCloud.com. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door, including Pacific Northwest Radio, KXCR, KBOO, KXCJ, and KCEI. And thanks to local band Jumpin' the Rails for their rendition of Smith Chapel, the theme song used on this show. And last but never least, thanks to each of you for joining me this week on another coastal adventure. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
Are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Lie down all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radical